Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
It's the new year, which means everyone is focused on wellness. And, you know, one of the crazy things, wellness means so much to different people. For some, it's dry January. The gyms are crowded until February hits. You know, I'm going to guess that the sales of potato chips and Frito-Lay stock is down right now. And then it gets to the financial aspect. You know, in January, as people are making their resolutions, financial wellness, one of the major sources of stress for not just most Americans, across the world, financial stress is rated as one of the top stressors out there, including the impact it has on people's health and mental well-being. So today we have excited Jane Barrett from MX, who is a frequent contributor, is being guest host today, and hopefully we're going to have her in that role a lot more. And Warren Hogarth, the CEO of Empower, which is a pretty interesting fintech startup that's made. You're hardly a startup anymore with the progress that you've made, which we'll get into a little bit later in the show. But it's been phenomenal to see your growth as you're getting closer to mainstream. But as we start, Jane, I know you have a strong opinion about this. What does financial health or financial wellness really mean? Because when you say it to people, they all nod their heads like, oh yeah, everyone wants to be healthier. But what does healthier living financially well really mean?
So thank you for having us both on the show, Jason. Glad to be here. There is a very, I would say, misunderstood view of financial health and financial wellness and financial literacy, and often it goes to a very low-level baseline, which almost feels like, you know, dental hygiene, you know, floss well or eat your vegetables. You know, don't pay bills late, have a baseline of emergency savings and save for the future, right? Which, just like floss your teeth, is kind of easy to ignore, number one. And if you're already doing it, number two, you're like, okay, so sweet, I'm good. I'm not living in my car. I'm financially well or financially healthy. So to me, financial wellness is a lot more complex and a lot more nuanced in terms of, well, A, there's a lot of room in the industry to meet the complexity of humans, right? So you could look at all of the numbers in my financial profile, and to someone else, it may seem like I'm, you know, in terrible shape and living on the edge. And to someone else, they're like, man, she's a one percenter, right? But the numbers mean different things to different people. And it does come down to, you know, it comes down to risk and your personal behavior. And there is, like I said, a lot of room to move with financial wellness.
Now, Warren, as someone who plays in this space, well, first, do you guys define Empower as a financial wellness, or do you think of yourselves as a neo or challenger bank? How do you define what Empower does? And around that, you know, how would you define what does financial wellness or health mean?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, what our goal is to make a material impact on people's financial lives. And so I think if you, and by the way, thanks for having me on today. You've lit me up on a fun topic to begin with. So yeah, it's really about, for us, it's making a material difference in the individual's financial lives. And so I suppose, you know, at the highest level, that is, at the end of the day, financial wellness, or some version of self-actualization around that. You know, underneath the covers, I think what's important is, how do you get people there? And there's, as sort of Jane was mentioning, there's many aspects, and it's highly individualized. One thing we're focused a lot on, actually, is one of the first steps is understanding your own sort of psychology of money. And a lot of us, depending on, you know, how we were brought up, the family we were brought up in, the culture we were brought up in, think of money as very, very differently. You know, some of us are really, really, it's very easy to spend money on others and very hard to spend it on ourselves. You know, for others, it's the opposite. It's very, you know, it's very gratifying to spend money on ourselves and hard to, you know, to give it away or do things for other people. And so actually one of the fun first steps, you know, to add an extra, you know, dimension in here is also understanding the individual and personal psychology of it. But anyway, going back to sort of Empower, what we do is we really try and understand you know, where somebody is as an individual today in their financial journey. What is it? What are sort of the quick wins, and what can we do, you know, in almost like a boot camp way to help them sort of kickstart in the right direction? And that's obviously great for the new year. And then we want to automate the future so that it's not to actually make a difference. Unlike going to the gym, you know, new year, you go to the gym, you know, you turn up for the first 2-3 weeks or what have you, then it becomes laborious, or, you know, the jobs or kids or life gets in the way. Because you've set things up with us, we want to basically automate that future bit so other things can get in the way, but we've got your back. And so that's sort of a little bit of our philosophy.
So Warren, who's the audience that comes to you, and what are the problems generally that they're looking to solve?
Yeah, so we focus very much on young professionals. So Empower has, as a product, has two main pieces. One is the sort of, we view it as sort of the financial assistant. It's where you download the app, you can, you know, connect your existing banking and financial institutions, get the snapshot of your finances, and then our software automatically goes to work analyzing it 24/7 and makes various recommendations on how to improve, whether that be your credit score, whether that be how to increase your savings, whether that might be, hey, you know, interest rates have come down, you can refinance your home loan because the yield curve inverted, or simply that you've got high credit card debt and there might be some ways to save there. You know, there's so many things we can focus on a day-to-day basis. And then the other part of the product, or just
finishing
up, is just the neobanking side, because what we found is a lot of people, you know, we help people with advice, but then taking action on it is very hard. So then we launched what we think of as best of breed products in terms of high interest checking accounts. We have a 1.6% APY checking account, same with savings, and we're launching some cash advance and other really cool products in the future.
Now, I'm curious, why did this segment, you know, young professional implies, you know, relatively educated, at least, you know, if not a level of affluence, kind of rising income in terms of what they can do. Why were they having a problem? And who else was trying to solve that kind of created a vacuum for you to come in and solve it?
Yeah. So, you know, like many startups, a lot of it comes from a sort of a personal experience. I'm an Aussie, as a few folks might be able to tell. But I came here about 15 years ago as someone who was financially educated and someone who was frankly quite fortunate. I was I was well educated and could access the job market quite easily. And yet I kept getting tripped up. I didn't appreciate that I had to borrow money to build a credit score. I thought if I was financially responsible and my day-to-day life and didn't need to borrow money, I was more likely to, you know, someone would lend to me in the future. Obviously, that was a very naive point of view, but, you know, if you don't come from the US, that's actually, you know, a pretty sane point of view. Through to many other things, I didn't have time to keep on top of my finances, whether it be optimizing my portfolio or refinancing various loans or missing fees or not realizing that, you know, if I ran up my credit card utilization above 30%, even though I was paying off my credit card every month, it was hurting my credit score. There was just so much going on that I couldn't keep up with it all, even though I was in a reasonable place. And it was costing me hundreds, in some cases, frankly, thousands or tens of thousands of dollars a year. And I went out and, you know, this is something before this, I was as a partner at Sequoia Capital and invested in a bunch of fintech companies. And so I'd seen these amazing sort of tailwinds and trends of neobanking and AI coming down the path. And I'd seen all of these people with this problem and try and tackle it in the past, but no one had nailed it. And then I was traveling and meeting with some great friends of mine who live in Conway, just outside of Little Rock, Arkansas. I didn't mention anything to them, and they start sharing their challenges financially with me. And it was just like, this is so solvable today with the latest technology. We've got to be able to automate our way to do this right.
You know, it's interesting that. you you brought up the pay down your credit to avoid over 30% utilization, because that's one I don't think many people know. And it's interesting. I was thinking about that just today because a certain credit card company linked to a certain very large online retailer makes it very difficult to access your full line. But, you know, a lot of people don't realize, hey, if you actually pay, you know, every 2 weeks to avoid your utilization going over 30%, that has a significant impact on that black box called your credit score. I'm curious, what other, you know, kind of counterintuitive insights have you raised where, you know, people just weren't aware about what they could or should be doing?
Yeah, so I think credit's a really big one. Mine dropped 80 points 1 month, and I've never missed a payment in my life for this exact reason. And I didn't miss the bill. I didn't pay interest on it. I just used my utilization went up. I'd say, you know, all of these things, the really interesting thing about software and finance is that we can help people across the spectrum. And so let's say you're doing really well and, you know, you have a mortgage on a nice place. What you don't realize, this is another one that happened to me the other day. I had refinanced my mortgage. Mortgage rates hadn't gone down, but what had actually happened in the market is the yield curve had inverted. And so while the Fed hadn't lowered rates, I was actually able to refinance my loan 6 months after taking it out and save 0.5% in interest on it, which ended up being, you know, thousands of dollars per year in savings. So that was a big one. Another one that we really try and help people on is around the automated saving side of things. So again, not everyone has time to check in very frequently and, you know, set money aside. And so one of the things we're able to do is, you know, look at your projected spending, look at your income, and, you know, on a regular basis, whether it be weekly or each pay cycle, stash some of that money away. You know, one of our users wrote in recently and she'd saved $8,700 in the year. And, you know, she's 3 or 4 years out of college and she, you know, this is this young professional thing. She'd gotten a new job and, obviously it had a little bit of a pay raises come out of that. But wasn't actually paying attention really on what's going on, and then looked up at the end of the year and that's how much we'd been able to save for her. So there's just lots of, it depends on the individual, which is again where software does a really good job, but it can be anything from paying down debt to stashing money aside to avoiding late fees, you know, refinancing when required. There's just so many things that you can, even, you know, negotiating insurance, negotiating bills, so many puts and takes. And, you know, typically we're able to find at least $500 in savings per year for our users. And in the automated savings, you know, it's $1,500 or more.
That's great. So how do you baseline that on both an individual level as well as, you know, an aggregate level? So I assume you have segments within your audience. Like, how does the software work in order to save this person has engaged with Empower and we have improved their financial outcome?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jane, and something I'm very focused on because I'm pretty quantitative. And so what we are able to do, because people typically will, you know, connect their existing Chase or Bank of America or PNC account is, you know, and you obviously, you know, this very well, we're able to get this history on the user. And so we're able to do this historical analysis to see what's going on. And that's often the first place we look for savings. And so we actually, when the user starts, think of it again, like sort of a, you know, we're in the new year going to boot camp. There's sort of some basic stuff to sort of set up and get right. And so we go through and we look at, okay, how much have they paid in fees? What could we do? Where is their insurance? Where are the bills that could be negotiated? How much interest are they earning on their checking and on their savings? You know, where are these loans at right now? Could they refinance them? And so we're typically able to do that benchmark right out the gate. And then it varies for different folks. Again, not everyone's in the situation that they have a mortgage. If you're not in that situation, often we're able to help on negotiating bills. Automating your savings is sort of the first step. The more you have or the more you make, often the more we're able to find in savings, because, you know, 0.25% or 0.5% on a loan, or, you know, an extra 1 percentage point or 2 percentage points on your interest rate, or reminding you to rebalance, can actually have a very, very big impact. So it graduates along the spectrum. But the good news is, no matter where you fit, there's usually at least 200 or 300 of savings, and often much, much more.
At MX, we work with about 2,000 different financial institutions and a number of fintechs. And, you know, we have seen a huge shift towards, you know, whether it's bringing in behavioral nudges, being able to consolidate accounts and get a full view of your finances. As I said, there's a lot of room for innovation and a lot of room to meet the needs of different customers. But what do you see in terms of trends? Especially, I think the challenger banks have done a pretty good job of carving out niches for themselves. You know, Ally obviously is a forerunner in the pushing up savings is a big one. You've got Aspiration that dives deep into ESG. But people are starting to find their lanes. What's your, and terrible surprise question for you, but like, what's your prediction for at least sort of the next 12 to 24 months in terms of what you see institutions getting into in the financial wellness space?
Yeah, I think, so I'm generally very bullish on the, you know, the neo or the challenger banking space overall, or the other fintechs playing in this space when it comes to financial wellness, more than I am the traditional institutions. And that's because a lot of the recommendations, nudges, and tips that the apps are making, like ourselves or others are trying to make, is it's at a foundational level, you have to have two things right. You have to have the right incentive structure, and most of the traditional banks, you know, reminding people to pay down their credit cards earlier, or warning them before the late fees, or even just making it really simple to pay off is not, you know, will eat up a fee stream. And then the second thing is the data side of things. You have to be able to structure this messy financial data to be able to get it right, so that you make the right recommendations and build trust. And so I think, you know, in every other major continent in this world, on the globe right now, whether it be in Europe or South America or India or China, or even within Southeast Asia, you've seen this rise of the neobanks that are providing better products and products that are focused on eating up the fee streams of traditional banks where people have been taken advantage of, or providing better products and services. And obviously the financial wellness and advice is a big piece of that. And so, you know, I think you're really just starting to see the Cambrian explosion of that here in the US. And I think it's great for consumers overall, and it provides a lot of choice.
Do you think people are choosing just a single neobank or challenger bank? Like, am I a Monzo customer or a Chime customer or an N26 or an Empower? Or are people using multiples? Is there such a, we're not seeing a wholesale displacement of the core checking account where people are closing their account, but we know these other things are growing explosively. So how do you see that kind of consumer behavior playing out?
Yeah, I'd say, right now it's more often a complement. So, you know, people will choose us for the high interest checking account, but they'll probably keep a foot in the old banking world because of, you know, one of their, you know, their spouse or their partner or their family or a business or a a home loan might still be offered by that other institution. And, you know, so you have to keep sort of one foot in the old world. What we're seeing, though, is, you know, this is a game of building trust and very long-term relationships. And, you know, the more we just focus on building a great experience, and, you know, the more bad experiences that people are having, ironic, you know, every time a new fee gets laid on, every time, you know, that you have to try and get in touch with your bank because there was a fraud problem and you can't get in touch, every time you need a new card and you can't get it. Like, every one of those, you know, situations just drives more and more people to make the neobank the primary. And so I think that's another big thing you'll see over this year and next year, is you'll see more and more primary accounts coming over to the neobanks.
So I got one really just a topical question in terms of the time of year. Like you started out, Jason, it's when people go to the gym and feeling really good with intentions. Warren, have you seen an uptick just in terms of downloads and usage and people setting goals this time of year? Or do you see it days of the week, times of the month? Like what's your learning in terms of how people's psychology work with goal setting for themselves?
Yeah, I'd say it's almost double this time of year in terms of the bump we see in terms of engagement and downloads. I think it also, you know, coincides with tax season. You've had that sort of binge up until the holiday, you know, season through Christmas and what have you. And so it becomes very topical, very top of mind, you know, people are trying to, or maybe you get the promotion. And so something is changing or putting pressure on the financial lives. And it really brings people, you know, to look at taking action. And so one of our big goals is to like capitalize on this moment to get you set up. And so then we can automate it going forward.
Now, building on that, what do people need to do to keep from falling off, right? So if now it's timely or they feel the financial pressure, they start going to the gym, you know, they're drinking more water, they're eating their veggies, and eventually it displaces. How do they avoid falling off the wagon when it comes to their financial health?
Yeah, well, I think this is, again, one of the big changes. And again, one of the beliefs we have is for many, many things, software can do a better job than humans. And this is where like not falling off the bandwagon can work very well. So the big part is getting set up. You know, there's something that you can do better. We'll give you a bunch of recommendations. The biggest thing to do then is just to click yes on the automation side of things. Yes, set aside $50 every week that I can afford to, or yes, send me an alert every time that, you know, my credit utilization goes above 30%. And once you're set up there, what we're really focused on doing is staying out of your hair unless there's something urgent or important for you to do. And because software can be monitoring things 24/7, at that point, we'll just send you a push or a text if there's something critical for you to do. And so then you can just focus on your day-to-day life. And in the background, you know, your savings are accumulating and we'll alert you anytime that, you know, something changes and there's something important for you to do.
Fantastic. Well, we're just about out of time here. Warren, if people want to learn about Empower or even just broadly improving their financial wellness, one, where can they learn about you? And two, where do you recommend elsewhere do you go to read other than reading Jane's stuff coming out of MX.com, which is one of my go-tos for financial wellness? What do you recommend?
Yeah, so on Empower, empower.me, so empower.me. And you can get the app at the Android Play Store or the iOS App Store. For me, if you follow at Warren Hogarth on Twitter, is probably the best way to sort of jump into a fun dialogue. If anyone has any follow-ups or questions or wants to jump into a debate, I think that'd be great. And then in terms of sort of financial wellness and news, it's interesting for me. This is, again, I actually think it's one of the challenges for me. There's like a small group of friends that I, you know, will post or reach out to, or that we sort of chat about. What I would encourage people to do is, you know, and some of these groups are now online. So actually one of the fun ones I'm part of is, I think it's Mustachians at Practice on Facebook. I don't know if I'm sure your listeners know of Mr. Money Mustache, but there's a bunch of fun groups like this on Facebook where there are some great conversations going on. And so I personally enjoy going into those groups because there are a lot of people that sort of walk the walk, and it's a great place to sort of get some differing opinions and then choose what works for your own psychology.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Warren, for joining us. Jane, for being co-host. Look forward to having just another great episode around how people can improve their financial wellness. Thanks for being on the show today.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network. Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
There are two types of leaders in business. Those who are nice, compassionate people. And frankly, they are the people who fail to get a lot done. Then there are those who can get everything done and so much more. But they are greedy, unethical, and self-centered. The Compassionate Samurai Business Hour with Kathy Fairbanks finds a way to use the best of both types of leaders to help you create a dynamic roadmap to success. Tune in every Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Business.
Today we live in a truly global environment. Business can more easily be conducted now in almost any part of the world. How do you, as a business owner or professional, navigate the ever-changing business landscape? Tune in to Leadership Beyond Borders with host Kimberly J. Lewis. With a worldwide resource of guests, you'll find out what opportunities and challenges surround diverse and virtual organizations. Listen live every Tuesday at 3 p.m. U.S. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Here with Brian Martucci, head of credit card and consumer insights for Money Crashers, one of the leading sites, particularly tailored to the millennials on giving financial advice. And as we continue the series around January is the month that all of us have pledged to lose weight, get in better shape, and most of all, clean up our financial lives, looking to get some of his insight around the consumer behaviors. Now, Brian, first, welcome to the show. I'd like to lead off, you know, let's just get right into it. What's the biggest mistake consumers make when they think about improving their financial life?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on. I would say the single biggest mistake that consumers make as we enter a new year is optimizing their savings account. So if you have a savings account with a large incumbent bank or a bank in general that's paying you less than, say, 1% APR on your savings, you're getting a bad deal, period. You can find a better yield in 15 minutes, open an account, transfer funds, have them in there in 2 days, start earning close to 2%, maybe higher, depending on what's available in your area. So first thing you can do right off the bat this month, get it done.
Well, that's a great suggestion. Why do you think people don't do that? That one seems obvious in this digital era that you can go compare rates. You can find it all online right now. Why aren't people taking that simple step?
I suppose inertia is a big factor. People probably overestimate the amount of time that the application is going to take. Like I said, I've applied for several bank accounts in the past year. It's never taken me more than 15 minutes. Often takes me less time than that. And I don't think I'm any kind of superhero when it comes to applying for bank accounts. So it's much easier than you think.
Yeah, I'd love to see if you did have a cape or a shield that, you know, said account application expert. Didn't see that in your LinkedIn profile. what else? So, I mean, the saving element is really important in terms of getting the best rate. What about ways that consumers are either doing a better job or screwing up the amount that they're able to save?
That's a good question. I feel like I'm a proponent of saving as much as you comfortably can. And, you know, that obviously means different things to different people, depending on where you're at. You have kids, debts, et cetera. But one thing that I think everyone can do and fit into their budgets, regardless of, you know, how much discretionary income they have or how much breathing room they feel like they have, is to bulk up their emergency fund. If you're going to save anything, focus on saving for a rainy day. The minimum that you should have in the bank is to cover 3 months of expenses. 6 months is better, and 9 months is ideal. That sounds like a lot, but you'll appreciate it when the time comes.
So as we think about what financial institutions can and should be doing to help here, right? Because I think as bankers or the fintech executives that are our listeners, you know, this advice is intuitive to them. This is something they're doing already, but their average consumer isn't. Do you have any recommendations for either apps people could use or hacks? Are there things banks should be doing to help, you know, consumers do a better job of doing this?
Sure. Well, I think one thing that every bank can and should be doing is to look to the fintech apps that are automating savings, and not just automating, which is table stakes at this point, but really making it almost an afterthought or not even a thought to save with every paycheck or every week or every month. You know, one of my go-to apps is Simple. It's basically just a banking, you know, lightweight banking app with automated budgeting and savings features. But I personally do well with savings goals buckets that have a defined purpose. And Simple is a resource that really helps me figure out where all of my money is going to each of those buckets and help me get there faster. So that's one I'd recommend, not to single any particular app out for the folks who might be listening.
Yeah, it's interesting. The bucket-based, or the way I think it originally started, you know, was called the envelope-based savings, where you physically put the cash into, you know, each one of those envelopes, and when it's gone, you have to either take it from another bucket or envelope, or you're kind of done spending. And digitization actually, you know, technology works against us there, right? Where, you know, there are fewer physical buckets. You know, Simple does that. I know of a few others. Do you know any other of the apps that you'd recommend that help with the budgeting? Like, are you a Mint user, or, you know, a big fan of Honeyfi for couples, or Honeydew is another one in that space? What other apps do you use that help you with that budgeting process?
Sure. Yeah, I actually am a fan of Mint. I don't know if that dates me or makes me a little old fashioned, but I find that it's, you know, has everything I need personally. Another app, I think, for more serious budgeters, folks who want to really drill down on their cash flow and get a handle on their expenses beyond just automating savings, is Tiller. It's spreadsheet based, but heavily automated. So you're not, you know, spending hours every week updating spreadsheets, which I think is a huge barrier to the average person when they're building a budget.
Well, that's probably a good recommendation for all of the bank executives who are listening right now. Right, they're the ones who like the spreadsheets and that level of detail.
Yeah. Spreadsheets, not a thing for most people.
Now, when it comes to fintechs versus banks, you've made the point around the higher yield on the savings accounts. When you think across the board, where do banks need to up their game to remain competitive with these new breed of providers, whether they're a large player coming from an adjacent space like a money manager or a retailer that's offering some incentives? Where do you think banks need to focus to really solve these needs for the consumer?
Sure. Well, in terms of optimizing rates or more broadly?
More broadly. I mean, so rates are part of it, and maybe the most obvious, and sometimes I would argue it's missed that even the fintechs screwed this one up, where they think experience, you know, trumps what the rate is. But at the end of the day, you know, financial is very measurable. Not that humans are always perfectly rational in their pursuit of, you know, kind of optimizing things rationally, but you can look at rate. What are the other elements, you know, that are differentiators?
Well, so, and, you know, this is another answer that might date me a little bit, but because it's one that banks have been going to for a long time, but the promotion, the account opening promotion, I still find is hugely helpful. We have one of our most popular articles on Money Crashes is actually just a roundup of current bank account promotions. And, you know, I personally, for example, belong to a regional credit union that no one listening, unless they live in my neck of the woods, has heard of, that hooked me because they were offering an account opening promotion years ago. It wasn't even that much. I think it was maybe $100. And that was enough to get me in the door. And literally get me in the door, I had to drive to the nearest branch, like 10 minutes away, because they didn't have an online application process at the time. So that's something that, you know, maybe banks are thinking beyond that, trying to kind of innovate past that. But, the building blocks still work.
So I'm curious. So they got you in the door with the $100, including over the hurdle of driving and physically being there. And then I'm assuming if they didn't have a digital app, they're probably not leading digitally. How have they managed to keep you in the door then? Or, you know, if they're listening, Brian is not leaving anytime soon unless you are. But, you know, what has actually kept you going and driving back to the branch to do your banking?
You know, I'd say a combination of factors, and some of them are probably fairly specific to myself and my own routine. But the human interaction, which is nice. I do have multiple online bank accounts, again, for rate optimization purposes. So the bulk of my liquid cash is actually not with this institution, but I go into the branch whenever I have a check, which isn't often, but I go there, deposit it, chat with the tellers there. When we've had, for example, we applied for our first mortgage there, even though it was a more cumbersome process than some of the fintechs that offer mortgages. So that's a big one. I also, kind of even beyond or more basic than that, I'm kind of a creature of habit. So literally going to the branch is sort of comforting for me. Again, I have a busy life just like everyone else, but, taking that half an hour out of my day on the occasion when I have to is, something that kind of helps in a way.
Well, I think this is going to be partially music to the ears for a number of the banks that are listening. Say, aha, see, branches are important. But you said something else, though. You have a lot of other online accounts that in some ways, what I think I'm hearing is you're using the branch and a credit union, that serves your needs, but it's just a small slice of what you do. They're not seeing the
entire
relationship. And you seem to have built out kind of this robust ecosystem of the other services you need to use.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, for example, they have, I think repeatedly at this point, tried to get my wife and I to, move some money into their investing services division. We have not done that for a variety of reasons. And, I'm not going to call them out on why, but, it'd probably be obvious to some of the listeners. And so we invest elsewhere. Again, we have high yield savings accounts elsewhere, insurance elsewhere, other financial services. And so it's really just that little foothold of kind of face-to-face contact, feeling like I have a place in the community, I guess you'd call it, the rest of my financial life doesn't. It's placeless.
Yeah. Now, the second part of your title is around credit card. And I know that is, a hot topic as there's been new entrants into the card space. What mistakes do consumers make when it comes to their credit card choices when they're looking to live a better financial life?
Sure. Yeah. I think a big one is the aspirational aspect of credit card seeking. And so if you travel a lot, and I travel fairly often, I work remotely, so I have that luxury. And I personally have a couple of travel credit cards that I feel I get very good value from. But not everyone who has a high-end travel credit card gets that value, frankly. Not everyone needs a Chase Sapphire Reserve card, even though I personally think it's probably the best travel card out there. People would disagree, despite the recent rate increase. But not everyone needs that. If you travel once or twice a year, you don't need that kind of travel card. I would say set your sights lower, general cash back card, flat rate. Earning 2% on everything is a lot better than earning a little bit more on travel purchases, but paying a lot more in an annual fee.
Now, of the articles that you guys have been writing at Money Crashers, what are some of your most popular right now that you would recommend? And if you could share some of the key takeaways for those who want to go check out Money Crashers, where should they start reading?
Sure. Well, we were just talking about credit cards. Our credit card roundups, we're updating them every day with new information, terms, rates, changing all the time. So I would definitely recommend checking out our best travel rewards credit card roundup and our best cashback rewards credit card roundup. Most folks who are looking for credit cards are going to choose one of, cards in one of those two categories, unless, of course, they have high interest balances that they're going to pay off, in which case they'd choose a balance transfer credit card or a credit building credit card. But yeah, definitely check out our roundups, chock full of information.
And so, love the idea of the roundups. What about some of the advice columns you've written? I found some were in some pretty esoteric topical areas. What are some of the more interesting areas that you guys have written about?
What don't we write about? One thing I was actually just thinking about before we began here was what to do about student loan debt and the difference, the relative merits of paying off student loan debt before credit card debt or vice versa. I was just looking through that, and that's a great primer for, I think, especially folks listening who might have escaped the student debt hole that a lot of folks are in, but know, of course, that consumers, millions and millions of consumers are facing crippling student debt that affects their ability to purchase homes, cars, and so forth. So I would recommend anyone who maybe doesn't have a handle on, the visceral nature of what student debt does to folks' finances should check out our content there. We've written a lot of different angles about student debt. That's a big focus for us.
And that's one of those non-obvious things, having come from the student loan world where, everyone knows that education is an investment, but they miss the fact that the return on that investment, the marginal return, goes flat pretty fast versus the amount of debt, and that rate does not go down. The phrase crippling makes a ton of sense. Co-host JP Nichols had an episode last year that people can find on the site with Nick Dukoff of Edmit that actually, if you haven't checked it out, Brian, it would be useful. It helps.
Absolutely.
Parents and children, as they're making the school selection up front, actually calculate what the ROI is and whether they're actually getting enough out of the financial aid versus could they go to a comparable university that's more likely to give them more aid. I thought that was a very interesting take where it allowed you to optimize the decision going in versus going to Money Crashers afterwards to figure out how to get out of the mistake.
How do you get out, yeah.
Yeah. So what other articles have you written lately that you're excited about or thematically you think that the banks and fintechs that are looking after their consumer best interests should be pointing them to?
Sure. One topic that we come back to a lot is credit scores, of course, because they're foundational to consumer health. This actually isn't super recent. I wrote this a couple of years ago, but it's it's topical as ever. I saw recently that the FICO score, like the average consumer FICO score, is higher than it's been. Either it's at an all-time high or a cycle high, which is I think probably concerning to folks who might know more about this than I do. But the effect of bad credit, again, for folks listening who are fortunate enough to have very good credit, might not intuitively grasp. For example, obviously, loan approval and loan rates. Loan approval is going to be harder. Rates are going to be higher. Terms are going to be more restrictive, but you'll also have trouble qualifying for housing. I have actually personally been in a place where in my days when my credit score wasn't so hot, I was not able to find rental housing in the community that I wanted because no one would rent to me. Higher insurance premiums, trouble getting a security clearance if you're in the public sector or public sector contracting, that's a big deal. Even things like cell phones that, again, not a lot of people think about, but you might be stuck with a prepaid phone if your credit's not good enough.
Good advice. Now, when you think about the future, where are the opportunities you think for bank and fintechs to fill in some of the holes within the problems and pains consumers are feeling?
Sure. I you know, just as a blanket statement, you mentioned that you talked to folks who are really big on their application process, on streamlining, on making things easier for the consumer. And that is great. I recently applied for life insurance for the first time. And I was, based on my previous experience with other forms of insurance, I thought, and what I knew about life insurance, I thought it was going to be a torturous process. It was not. It took me, I don't want to say 15 minutes, but let's say half an hour from start to finish. I was covered. And that's great. So I think anything, you know, and it's, I'm not going to drill down into specific sectors or industries, but just across the board, anything that can be done to keep the consumer feeling as if they are, have agency in a process and that they are valued as they're going through that process is going to be a huge help, a huge differentiator.
You know, this idea of agency, we talk about onboarding and digital applications and, you know, my least favorite word of the last 5 years, omnichannel, all the time, but we don't talk a lot about, you know, the idea of the customer having agency in that. You know, how does an institution, you know, give that agency and that, you know, kind of level of trust back to the customer in the application process?
You know, I think creating either the reality or the illusion of there being someone right there with you, you're doing that, you know, at this point, this is all happening in the digital space. But, you know, my life insurance application, for example, I felt as if I had any concerns or issues, I could pick up the phone or open a chat window and immediately have my question answered. And whether or not that was true or not, probably wasn't. I still, that was kind of a blanket for me. And so, you know, this might just be my personal preference talking, but really having that sense of an apparatus just out of the customer's reach is hugely, you know, important for me. And I'm sure this is not news to anyone who's, you know, thought about drill down to the data of customer experience, but it's a huge differentiator for folks like me.
Well, and I find this curious, you know, you as, you know, an editor for a very large millennial site on personal finance, you bank at a credit union that you drive to, having that escape valve, even though it's a digital one, not necessarily going in, is important as part of the agency to know that that help exists, is an important part of the process. But at the same time, it sounds like you also really value the ease, convenience of digital, that, you know, if I can, you know, push on that for a second, is that an accurate restatement of you need the blend of the two?
Yeah, I think that is. And you know, I might be a little bit kind of occupying a middle ground between someone who, you know, might be a little old fashioned in terms of what I value from face-to-face interaction and so forth, and someone who's, you know, complete digital native, who is fully comfortable but indeed prefer not to interact with humans as they're going through these processes. So, you know, is my experience relevant to someone in a different generation? It may or may not be, but I do think it's more, I do think it is what I've expressed is a fairly common view based on the research I've done and the folks I've talked to. And I think, you know, people in this space underestimate the enthusiasm that even folks in the younger generation have for fully automated. There's still room for that handholding or that, just that, again, that security blanket of having people there in the background if you need them.
All right. So as we're running out of time, you know, want to do a quick recap. You know, your push for the consumers is, one, don't settle for a low rate. Go online, open a high yield savings account. Two, build up, pay yourself first and make sure that you're building that emergency savings fund. And then what advice would you give for the institutions that are listening when they're thinking about improving the financial lives of their customers?
you know, make me feel like I am a valued human being. Make it easy for me to get through the process, but don't make it so easy that I'm not going to be able to talk to someone if I do need help.
Fantastic. So Brian Martucci, head of credit card and consumer writing at Money Crashers, and it's moneycrashers.com, correct, for all the financial advice you've been writing about? Well, thank you for joining us. And here is to everyone living a better financial life for 2020.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.